This is KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
Some decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court stand the test of time. That includes one case that's gone unchallenged for nearly a century. It's a case that, in some ways, Austin is currently rehashing. Yep, we're talking about Code Next. That's the city's rewriting of rules that determine what you can build in the city and where. And as KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports, if we listen closely enough, we can hear how the current fight sounds a lot like the one that took place 90 years ago in the highest court of the land.
Last month, nearly 200 people filled a Presbyterian church in northwest Austin. Attendees sat in maroon leather-backed chairs. One man in the back row read a book and only looked up every so often to see what was going on. Mayor Steve Adler sat near the pulpit.
Mayor, you get the big seat.
He'd come to answer questions about Code Next from members of the Allendale Neighborhood Association.
This is a magical place, I think.
As magical as Austin may be, lines have been drawn across the city over Code Next. Do we allow for denser housing? If so, where? How will this affect affordability, gentrification, both current and future? On that November night, talk quickly turned to housing types. One of the goals of Code Next is to create more housing choices, something other than the single-family homes and large apartment buildings that dominate the city. But duplexes, triplexes can be a hard sell when oftentimes it means tearing down a current home.
When a home is torn down and a duplex is built instead of a single family home, that each one of the duplex units costs less than what the single family, each one individually costs less because they're smaller.
I've been to a lot of these meetings. The idea of a city telling any neighborhood what can be built there gets booed. So how did we get here? How did cities get the right to tell us what we could do with our property? I mean, in a historical sense, like way back. It all starts with a court case in Ohio. And sure, law stories can be boring, all that legalese. But at its core, this is a love story.
He marries a woman and is deeply in love with her.
Devoted to her, crazy about her.
And she dies.
We'll get to that. The year's 1922. We're in a small Ohio town called Euclid.
Which is a suburb of Cleveland, right next to the Cleveland, right on the lake, Lake Erie.
Population's fewer than 10,000 people.
I'm Bill Fischel. I'm professor of economics at Dartmouth College.
Fischel writes about the economics of zoning. At the turn of the 20th century, cities began telling property owners what they could do with their land. In 1916, New York City adopted its first comprehensive zoning plan. The whole idea behind these first plans was to ensure citizens' health and safety. For example, maybe we shouldn't build a factory near a house. The village of Euclid adopted its first zoning plan in 1922, but at least one family was unhappy.
One of the property owners who wanted to use his property for an industrial use had part of it zoned for residential use.
Their name was Ambler, William and his son William.
The owner of the Ambler Realty Company took it to court.
By rezoning the land, the Amblers argued, the town had run them out of money. So the company sued Euclid for violating its private property rights. A man named Newton Baker represented the realty company.
And he won. Had the entire zoning law struck down in federal court, the initial trial court.
In his decision, Judge David Weston Haver deemed comprehensive zoning by a city unconstitutional. In his opinion, he wrote about what he saw as zoning's negative effects.
The true reason why some persons live in a mansion and others in a shack, why some live in a single-family dwelling and others in a double-family dwelling, why some live in a two-family dwelling and others in an apartment, or why some live in a well-kept apartment and others in a tenement, is primarily economic.
He went on.
The result to be accomplished is to classify the population and to segregate them
according to their income. That's the language that the lower court used. Hi, my name is Richard Kahlenberg. I'm a senior fellow at the Century Foundation.
That's a left-leaning think tank in New York. Kahlenberg wrote an op-ed in the New York Times earlier this year. He argued that the decision of this lower court nearly 100 years ago was a prophetic one, that separating types of houses creates economically segregated cities.
In communities that have higher levels of exclusionary zoning allowed by the Supreme Court in Euclid, we see much greater economic segregation of people. And that matters because where you live has a great deal to do with what kind of life you can enjoy.
But the lower court's decision was nothing but a pit stop in the journey of Euclid versus Ambler. The village appealed.
Then when this got to the Supreme Court...
Okay. Actually, Richard, I did forget. Yes. 1 second. I promised people a love story. A man named James Metzenbaum was on the village council for the approval of Euclid's zoning plan in 1922. He'd lived in the village with his wife, Bessie. And as the story goes, he was a devoted husband. They were married for more than a decade before she died suddenly in 1920.
At that point, the sad lawyer moved back to a hotel in Cleveland.
Michael Wolff is a local government professor at the University of Florida. He wrote a book titled Zoning in America, Euclid versus Ambler. And he says Metzenbaum visited his wife's grave often, so much so that...
He had a fireplace installed in the mausoleum and a bed where he used to spend the night. I know this is quite morbid.
Bessie's grave lay on the east side of Cleveland in a cemetery on what was called Euclid Avenue. Driving from Cleveland to Euclid, Metzenbaum would have passed her grave.
He had such an affection for wanting to preserve the character of that town, that village that he had lived with his former wife, with his late wife.
When the town was sued, Metzenbaum agreed to represent Euclid, which brings us to the Supreme Court.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, oyez.
The case was argued twice in front of the court. Finally, on November 22, 1926, an opinion came down.
If not for James Metzenbaum's zealous devotion to his wife, maybe the folks in Austin wouldn't have anything to complain about right now.
In other words, as Wolff says, a broken heart got us zoning. The village of Euclid had won.
The local government had made a not unreasonable decision to divide the village up and to classify land by use, area, and height. They have the power. In fact, I would argue they have the authority to regulate on behalf of the public to protect the public health, safety, morals, and general welfare.
For Euclid, that meant keeping factories out of neighborhoods. But that wasn't the only part of the decision. In Euclid's zoning plan, the village separated single-family homes from duplexes, duplexes from apartments. The Supreme Court said that was okay, too.
In part of the opinion, the court discussed apartments and said that in the wrong setting, an apartment can be a parasite. It can monopolize the rays of the sun and otherwise create situations that might endanger health and safety.
Justice George Sutherland, one of the more conservative justices, wrote the opinion. He talked about why single-family neighborhoods should be protected from other denser housing.
The coming of one apartment house is followed by others, interfering by their height and bulk with the free circulation of air and monopolizing the rays of the sun, which otherwise would fall upon smaller homes, and bringing as their necessary accompaniment the disturbing noise incident to increase traffic and business, and the occupations by means of moving and parked automobiles of larger portions of the street, thus depriving children of privilege of quiet and open spaces to play, enjoyed by those in favored localities until finally the residential character of the neighborhood and its desirability as a place of detached residence are utterly destroyed.
There's a lot of vacant and commercially underutilized space in Austin.
We're back in Allendale in the present day. At this meeting, it's hard not to hear echoes of that 1926 Supreme Court opinion.
Why is there not a concerted effort to develop that land before destroying the quality of traditional central city neighborhoods?
Scott Ehlers, the Neighborhood Association president, reads off questions for the mayor. Another woman stands up to talk about parking.
Right now, we're so packed with cars. It's crazy off of Burnett. And when you want to increase housing density, how are we going to get around? We can barely get to the HEB. Thank you.
Euclid versus Ambler gave Austin and other municipalities across the country the legal right to zone and rezone their land. In a city where nearly half the housing units are single-family homes, it also gave some Austin neighborhoods arguments against change. But Euclid versus Ambler gave us one more thing, and this one's really bad. 2 years after the Supreme Court declared zoning to be legal, the city of Austin approved its first comprehensive zoning plan. The 1928 plan denied services to black residents who did not live east of what is now I-35. In many ways, it created the segregated city we've inherited today. Some hope Code Next can desegregate the city. Others hope it won't make current segregation worse. Audra McGlinchey, KUT News.
Thank you.